Okay, here we go. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 5, the addressing chapter. It's a two-part chapter, so this is going to be part one. And a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you all on the other side of the pond. We had ours yesterday. How are you all, magic student?
Fine, thanks, Elise.
Very well.
I'll be fine.
Fine, Elise.
I'm not going to do my Irish accent because it sucks. Hiya, Pat. Hiya, Marshall. Hiya, Nerissa. And hiya, Tim. We have a small but select group, as Kylie might say, from the other course. But well, let's hit the road and do some of this addressing stuff. We're roughly about halfway through the course, and I'd just like to commend everybody on the quality of work that's coming in from the worksheets, the exam results, etc., etc. So it's all good, and I'm sure you'll all go on to do well with this course. For those of you who have not yet paid fees, you might want to check in to see if that's happened, and everything will be good. As I said, we're about halfway through. All is well. Are there any questions up to this point? All right. Silence is the stern reply. Evidently not. We've either bored you silly with the course up so far, or you're all just hanging out there to do some addressing. So let's hit the road. All right. Let's get on with it. Addressing is one of those things that can be hard to teach, hard to understand, and this is one of those chapters that is a difficult chapter to comprehend. There are a lot of new concepts, and as I said back in Chapter 3 on our last hard slog, which you all did very well with, by the way, it's okay to get things wrong. These are new concepts, and the more you practice at it, the more you get things wrong, the more you'll actually learn. So it's okay to do that. All right, now Cisco has it starts off. I'm going to try and break this at 5.4, which is where Jackie and I broke this 6 months ago when we both guided people through it, and I'll see if we can break it at the same point to facilitate consistency between the two. Between the two separate programs, Jackie's and mine, and my one on my own. Okay, this Cisco goes straight into IP addressing and subnet masks. And basically it says here, a host needs an IP address to participate on the network. Now this is absolutely true. Without an IP address, we don't get any network, therefore we can't even participate on the big network called the internet. Now, as we've learned before, the IP address is a logical address. So that's as opposed to the physical address from the MAC address, which we discussed back in Chapter 3. It has to be properly configured in order for you to communicate with other hosts and other devices. Now, the IP address is assigned to the internet connection, sorry, to the IP address is assigned to the network interface of the host. So, I remember explaining this to Nerissa some time ago. The network interface, or the network adapter, will have an IP address. And this is why some of you have been doing IP configs and seeing maybe two IP addresses, and that's one for each of your interfaces if you're working on a computer with a wireless interface. And for those of you with laptops, I know Kim and I have been configuring her new laptop this week, and we've been, you know, testing to see if we've been on wireless, etc., and that sort of stuff, and picking up IP, you know, just looking at what goes on with IP config and that sort of stuff. All right. Now, rather than just going straight into what Cisco does, we here at Cavi do like to have a closer look at the binary system and the decimal system and some of the comparisons. So that's what we feel that we should probably do now, and before we drop back into the sort of 5.1, 5.2 section. Basically, an IP address is a 32-bit number. Now, this is going to be an interesting concept here. We've got four lots of 8 bits. Sorry. So this, as we've probably seen so far, the smallest unit is a bit, and we have 8 bits per byte. So therefore, if we've got a 32-byte number and we divide it by four, we'll have four lots of 8 bits, which make up 32. So there you go. Now the numbers, as you go through, and for anyone who goes on to Discovery 2 or maybe Kerry's exploration class, the numbers 8, 16, 24 and 32 are going to become really second nature, because it's at these boundaries we actually decide the classes of networks. And you know, when you get into advanced subnetting and custom subnets and that sort of stuff, you'll be, you know, talking about different bits. For example, on a Class C network, for example, which we'll explain in greater detail later on, we actually have 24 bits, or the first three octets. So we'll come back to that. 24 bits is for the host, and 24 bits is for the network part of the IP address, and 8 bits is for the host. So we'll explain why as we go on. I don't want to explain that to you now. Each of these four groups are referred to as an octet. And the reason we have an octet, we have them separated by dots, and that is known as dotted decibel notation. And again, we'll come back to that a bit later on. Now, is any of this making sense at the moment?
Yes, sure, that makes
going
sense.
On with him? Yep, we've seen addresses like 192.168.0.1, etc., and that is referred to as dotted decimal notation. And in some of my troubleshooting I do with some of the advanced people, I might say, well, what's in the fourth octet, for example? Meaning, in the case of, say, Kim's network, 192.168.0.1, I would expect to see a host on that address. I think her router's on that address. So, I would ask what's in the fourth octet. Okay, Marshall, how are you coping with this?
This is easy.
Lovely. Well, this is just it. It isn't as hard as a lot of people make it out to be. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
You may.
When you're talking about the octet, you called it, and you're talking to see what's in the fourth octet, which way do you count it, from the right or to the left? Which octet side do you want, the 192 or the one?
Oh, I see what you mean. The fourth octet's the one on the right-hand side, and we'll look at that a little bit closer a bit later on. But because we're going to actually talk in parts of the advanced chapter 5, well, let's say the advanced chapter 5, we'll talk about why that is so, but I didn't want to get into that at the moment because I just wanted to explain a little bit about the binary system, and so I just didn't really want to get ahead of that. But yeah, basically the right-hand side, because that actually defines the host. So in other networks where we've got Class B networks, we'll actually have 16 bits. The first 16 bits, which is the first two octets, will be for the network, and the second 16 bits would be for the host. That's a Class B network. And a Class A network is the first eight bits is for the it's for the network, and the remaining 24 bits is for the host. So that's why on Class A and B networks you can have a lot more hosts but less networks. On a Class C network you can have more networks and less hosts. You can have up to without going into advanced subnetting, you can have up to 256 addresses minus 2, which is 254 hosts on a Class C network, and we'll explain all that why. I don't want to get into it, but that's all, as you said, with the right-hand octet, which is, in the case of Kim's example, I just said would be 1. Is that helping, Pat?
That clarifies it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Okay, well, as we know with the binary system, what does binary have to do with all of this business? Why can't we just do it in decimal? Well, humans do things in decimal because we can understand it. The actual IP address is just a binary number. But imagine if you had to type, like 11111 or 111101 something or other dot 011111 something or other dot, etc., etc. 10 or 11 out of place would render the computer off the network, and the host wouldn't be able to communicate. So it's just so hard to get all these ones and zeros in the right spot. So that's why we convert it to the decimal system, so we can understand it. Hence the term dotted decimal notation. Okay, we know that with, especially with that exam question in chapter 1, how many values can we have with a binary number? There can only really be ones and zeros.
Two.
It makes two values. Yeah, two values. Yep, we've had that discussion, haven't we?
Yes, because I got it wrong.
Yeah, so there you go. So we can have, and that's why we call it binary. Now, everybody, in the normal world, what numbering system do we use?
Decimal.
Decimal.
That's right. Decimal. And the root word for decimal is dec. December used to be the first month, the 10th month of the year. We speak of the decade, which is every 10 years, and etc. So dec is our root word. Okay, back in school, who remembers talking about the ones column, the tens column, the hundreds column, and the thousands column?
Yes. I do.
Yep,
exactly. Now, this actually refers to something known as powers. And I don't just mean the Spy Who Shagged Me or Austin Powers. I mean powers. What is a power? Power is a number times a number times itself, or multiplied by itself. Now, if we're saying 10 to the power of 2 or 10 to the second, we're really saying 100. If we're saying 10 to the power of 3, we're really saying 1,000. So why are we saying that, gang? Well, it's very easy, because nothing in the ones column, nothing in the tens column, but we have a number, that being 1, in the hundreds column. Is that making sense?
Yep.
Yes.
Makes sense.
So if I had the number 11, what would that be, gang?
1 in the tens column. Or 10 in the tens column and 1 in the elevens column.
Yeah, I like to think of it as one lot of 10 in the ones column. In the tens column, sorry. One lot of 10 in the tens column and one lot of 1 in the ones column. And what do you get if you add them up? You get 11. So obviously, what would happen if I had 121?
1 in the hundreds column, 2 in the tens column, and 3 in the ones column.
121, 1 in the ones column. So I'd add those up. So 121 would be 1 in the 100s column, 2 in the 10s column, which would make 120, and 1 in the 1s column. Or else if you had 3, you'd get 123. Now the same thing if I had 525. I've had 5 lots of 10, 5 in the 100s column, sorry, 2 in the 10s column, and 5 in the 1s column. You add them all up, and there's 525. Not bad. Now, of course, another name for this, and I know this is probably pretty basic for you, Nerissa, because Auntie Vera was a maths teacher, is, of course, base 10. Where's Auntie Vera when you need her?
Yes.
That's Nerissa's mum, by the way. Hopefully looking down on me right now, giving me a helping hand with this stuff. I hate maths. Okay, so if we're looking at the number 10, we have two columns. One and I've got a 1 in the 10s column and a 0 in the 1s column. If we have the number 100, we have 3 columns. And if we have the number 1,000, we have 4 columns. Funnily enough, the same principles I've given you that apply to the powers of 10, also that apply to the base 10 numbering system, also apply to the base 2 numbering system, which is binary. In other words, when we convert to binary and having to deal with this, we actually use the same principles, believe it or not. Okay, now if I say 10 to the power of 1, 10 to the power of 1 is what?
10.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. So I only simply get 10. And if I say 10 to the power of 2, I naturally get 100. 3 binary is, as Nerissa said before, we only get 2 possible values. It's like really 10 in base 10. 10's our boundary. It's where we have to change over to the next column. In binary, 2 is where we have to change over to the next column. So obviously if we start at 0, the 9 is the 10th number, and the 10th number is the first number in the next column. So we change places in 2 if we're going to come to binary. Let's have a look. So in binary, we have a column of 1s, a column of 2s, a column of 4s, and a column of 8s, and a column of 16s. Wow, how about that, gang? So if you can imagine, this is where Ian Murray really did us a lot of good a few years back, actually. He made these pegboards, and unfortunately due to, you know, sending wood around the world, it's hard to send them out. But essentially they were a pegboard with a 1s column, a 2s column, a 4s column, 6 column, an 8 column, sorry, not a 6 column, a 2s column, a 4s column, an 8s column, etc., 16s column, a 32 column, a 64 column, and a 128 column. And that gave us the ability to put pegs in these columns if we wanted to play around with binary numbers. And there was a division for each of the octets, so this would start again in the second octet. So we'd have a pegboard with 8 columns in it. On the right-hand side, then a dividing line to cause a demarcation between that and the next octet, and so on. So he had 32 holes across the pegboard. He actually had 3 rows of 32 holes, because we had the same thing for the subnet mask and the network address, which we would come to a bit later in subnetting. So it was a pretty ingenious device, so much so that I'm led to believe that Cisco did pick that up. Okay, so we now know that 2 times 1 is 2, obviously. 2 times 2 is 4. 2 times 4 is 8. 2 times 8 is 16. 2 times 16 is 32. 2 times 32 is 64. 2 times 64 is 128. And 2 times 128 is 256. You can also say 2 to the second. 2 to the third is 8. 2 to the fourth, or 2 to the power of 4, is 16. And 2 to the power of 5 is 32, 2 to the power of 6 is 64, 2 to the power of 7 is 128, and 2 to the power of 8 is 256. Now, how are we travelling so far with all
no
of this?
No problem.
Going well. So instead of our 10s, 1s column, 10s column, 100s column, 1,000s column, 100,000 column, etc., we actually just have the 1s column, 2 columns, 4 columns, 8 columns, 16s column, 32s column, and the 64s column, etc., and the 128 column. Now, 128 is where we're going to stop. We're not going to go to the 8, to the next one, because that goes into the next boundary. So we really want to concentrate. Remember, we start at 1s, so the first column. So we do actually have 8 columns. Okay, we now know that there's 8 bits to a byte. And another name of this 8-bit byte is an octet, which I've already said. We know that oct is the root word for 8. As I said before, dec is the root word for 10, which is why we get octet. October was once the 8th month of the year. We have 8 diatonic notes on the keyboard, and we refer to that as an octave. Why is all this important? We've actually got to divide the network up into different categories and different places on the network. Now, has anyone thought of this like a phone numbering system yet? Because that's what it is. I mean, say in my area of Melbourne, we have a phone number, for example, like mine being, I live in the 9807 area, which defines some of a suburb called Chadston and parts of a suburb called Mount Waverley. And this is why we need a logical numbering system or a hierarchical numbering system. Basically, we know that in, say, parts of America, 623 was the area that defined where Jackie lived, West Valley. 905 defines parts of Hamilton where Kim is, etc. And in different parts of, say, southern Ontario, or different parts of the east of Melbourne, you're going to have different, as we call them, prefixes to telephone numbers. Then the rest of the phone number, again, usually on the right-hand side of the phone number or towards the right-hand side of the phone number, is your own, and that defines your little part of the world. We can sort of relate that to IP addressing. Now, given that we've got our eight columns, sort of 0 to 7, which are our eight columns, and we know 2 to the power of 7 is 128. If we add up, if we add 128 plus 64, what do we get, Narissa?
192.
Yep. And then what happens if we add 32 to that?
224.
Yep. See, Mather was a maths teacher. Let's add 16 to 224 and see what we get. 240. Then we, if we add 8 to 240, we got 248. And if we add 4 to 248, we get 252. And if we add 2 to 252, we get 254. And if we add 1 in our 1s column, though I'm going from left to right here, it's 254, we get 255. The 32-bit IP address is a logical address and is made up of two parts, as I said before, the host portion and the network portion. It's a bit like our phone numbering system that I said. We have our we have our little part of the world on the right-hand side of the number, mine being 8898, and we have our prefix on the left-hand side of the phone number. And further out we go too, we have an area code that defines Melbourne, 03, or 3 if you're dialing in from overseas. We have an area code that defines Australia, which is 61. So that's why we often put plus 61. For America and Canada, it's all 1. For New Zealand, it's 64. So as you move from the left, the right to the left, we're defining a bigger area of the telephone number. Now, with our IP address, both the network part and the host part are required to have the IP address be successful, as both parts of the phone number is required. You know, the prefix or area codes, etc. So without the right phone number, you're not going to get through to who you're ringing up. Now, in the example given here in the notes, 192.168.18.52, I think it is. Hang on, where am I? Got lost here. Yeah, .18.57, actually. The 57, being the right-hand entity, defines the host. Now, this is known as hierarchical addressing because the network portion indicates the network on which unique address is. Now, as we know from Chapter 3, routers only need to know which network to get to. They route traffic between networks, not between hosts. So, in other words, the routers don't really need to know the location of individual hosts. It usually comes back to our MAC address, etc., or with inside the network. Now, how do hosts know which portion is the network and which portion is the host part of the address? This is actually the job of the subnet mask, and I'm sure most of you have been cranking in network settings from time to time, and you've seen this subnet mask, and you've just belted in 255.255.255.0. And as we learnt from adding up all those figures before, and I got 255, that means every bit is set to 1. So in our 8-bit octet, in our 8 bits, if we converted that number out to binary, we would have 8 lots of 1s, dot 8 lots of 1s, 8 dots of 1s, and 1 lot of zeros. So 8 lots of 1s, 8 lots of 1s, 8 lots of 1s, and 1 dot of 0. So that's why we see 255.255.255.0 as a default subnet mask on our domestic home networks. Because remember, I added up all those columns before. I added up 128, 192, 224, and 240, 248, 252, 254, 255, and there it is. So I added up all those columns. In other words, I added up all my columns, basically, within that first octet, and that's how I got my 255. Like the IP address, the subnet mask is therefore how many bits long? Anyone?
Maybe 32.
Not maybe, definitely 32. It's exactly the same length of bits as the IP address. Well done. The notes glaze over this a bit, but there's a comparison known as ANDing, which compares the IP address with the bits in the IP address, rather, with the bits in the subnet mask. And I'm not sure whether it goes into it or whether it's just that Jackie did, but we can actually determine the network address from all of this, which we'll do a bit later on. So comparing the IP address and the subnet mask will actually give you another address known as the network address. And that's why Ian put three rows on the pegboard. When a host sends a packet, it compares its own subnet mask with the IP address and with the destination with its own IP address and destination address. If the network bits match, then the information stays on the same network, and the packet can then be delivered locally. If they do not match, the sending host forwards the packet to the local router interface to be sent onto another network. To get the network address. Now let's look at Kim's network again, because we know that the network address is going to be 192.168.0.0, and we know that we can't actually have anything on 192.168.0.255, because that's the broadcast address. Now do we remember back in Chapter 3 we were discussing the network address and the broadcast address?
Yes.
So therefore, if there's 255 values starting at 0, there's actually 256 possible addresses on a Class C network. Minus 2, how many hosts can we put on Kim's network?
254.
Absolutely. So Kim's already got two computers now, plus her router. So she's got 254 minus that 3 to go before she runs out. Now, there is a way of subnetting this off, which we won't discuss here because it's sort of in the discovery too. But we know that we can have 256 possible addresses minus 2 on the Class C network. On the Class B network, it's something like 16,500 and something or other. Right, is it 16,530 something? I've got to get my notes out to have a look at that, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So with the Class B network, there's actually more addresses possible on each network than what there were on the Class C. On the Class A network, there's something like 16 million of them. So that's why you get a lot of addresses. And of course, as you know, the more hosts on a network would cause more broadcast traffic, and more broadcast traffic would cause what?
Collisions.
There you go. So that's why people do subnetting and break these networks down, and we'll come back to that. But if you understand these principles, you don't necessarily have to learn how to do subnetting in this chapter just yet. However, it's the concept that I want to introduce you to. It has two benefits, subnetting, and firstly, it breaks down the network so that you don't have so much broadcast traffic. And the other thing is that you can actually, because you need a router between each of the networks, you can actually section off different parts of a company, like the finance section can be sectioned off from the sales and marketing section, and it adds a level of security. To find the network address of, say, let's say Kim's network, I have to introduce you to a concept called anding. Now, if we convert all of these numbers out to binary, like the subnet mask, for example, we're going to end up with 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1, and 1 lot of 0. Now, I was going to bring up the Windows calculator if I could find it here in Windows.
Maybe it's in accessories.
Can't even find accessories under Windows 7.
I just typed it in and it appeared in the search box.
Oh, here we go. Okay, I should be able to work this out in my head. Binary calculations will come later near the end. Look, let's just say we won't work out about the network address yet, but if you can compare them in binary, you'll get 1 and 1 makes 1, and 1 and 0 makes 0. So basically, the anding process, you have to have 1 and 1. And that way, you actually, once those numbers are stacked on top of each other, you can actually convert out and find the network address. So all zeros in the network portion, let me see where we've gone, mucked this up completely. All right, I'm going to come back to some of the addressing next week because I haven't prepared my notes properly and I don't want to make a muck up of the converting out from binary. So I think we might come back to doing some binary next week and I'll just do it on the spreadsheet again with the pegboard. Okay, types of IP addresses is another part of this. The IP address and subnet mask work together to determine which how things happen. Okay, how do we do this? Okay, IP addresses are actually grouped into 5 classes. We've talked about A, B, and C, but let's talk about them as the notes portray it. Okay, classes A, B, and C are commercial addresses and assigned to hosts on the internet. Class D is reserved for multicast use, and Class E is kept aside for experimental use. Okay, now class C addresses have three octets for the network portion and one for the host, as I've already said. And therefore, the default subnet mask is 24 bits. It's 24 bits because we're using up the first three octets. Class C addresses are usually assigned to small networks. Okay, in class B land, we have two octets to define the network portion and then the other two octets to define the network, the host portion. So how many bits in each octet then? Oh, how many bits in each portion, not in, in each octet, but how many bits in each portion of that address?
Eight.
There'll be eight bits per octet. So if there's two octets in each portion, that must mean there's what?
16.
Yep, 16 bits for the network and 16 bits for the host. Okay, the default subnet mask in this instance will be 255.255.0.0. Okay, these addresses are typically used for medium-sized networks, and in class A LAN, we only have one octet to represent the network portion and three octets to network to represent the host portion. So, in which case, how many bits in the network portion of a class A address game?
Well, there'd only be eight.
That's correct. You are correct. Okay, in this instance, the default subnet mask is 255.0.0.0. Now, notice I've been using the word default subnet mask because in advanced subnetting, you can actually borrow bits off the host and actually make a subnet mask that had some bits in the next octet, which is when you start seeing, /9 addresses, /10, and for the class Bs, you might see /17 addresses, or class C, you might see a standard class C network is actually referred to as a /24 because there's 24 bits. But if you were borrowing bits off the host address, or the host part of the address, you'd actually you could actually make a /25 or a /26, and in doing so, would decrease the number of hosts on each network. But that's getting a little bit of advanced. But it's a bit of fun to play with those. Anyway, back to your class A. These addresses are assigned to large organisations. Okay, if the first octet has a value in the range of 192 to 223, it can be defined as a class C address. Okay, if you see an address that starts off with 129 anything to 223 anything in the first octet, that's a class C address. Now, I think I've got these things written down much better. Let's have a look. Yeah, let's look at my own spreadsheet that I wrote up years ago and see what we can see out of this. Okay, the class A range is 1. Now, this is we're talking about the first octet here. So if you see an address that is anything in the first octet, 1 to 127, is a class A address. Anything with 128 to 191 in the first octet is a class B. And anything with 192 to 223 is a class C. And I actually do have the official figures here of how many hosts you can actually have on them if you want me to tell you. So basically on a class A network, because I worked all this out a few years ago, you can have 16,777,214 hosts on a class A network. On a class B network, you can have 63,534 hosts. And on a Class C network, you can have 20, as we've discussed before, 254 hosts. Consequently, the number of networks you can get when the amount of hosts are there's a lower number of hosts, you have a greater number of networks. And on the Class C, you can have 2 million of networks anyway. And it's digressing a bit here. Okay, now this is a bit difficult to sort of read. Okay, public and private IP addresses. This is where it gets interesting. Okay, all hosts that connect to the internet require a publicly assigned IP address. Because of the finite number of 32-bit addresses that are available, there is a risk of running out of IP addresses. Now, if the Windows Secrets article I read this morning was correct, we have now officially run out of 32-bit IP addresses.
Yes, I read that.
IPv4. You read that too. So that's it. We're gone. That's it. We might as well go home, pack up. The world is about to end. No more internet. Well, not quite. We've actually run out of assigning them because there's something like 4.3 billion of them, I think. that they can be handed out to different internet service providers in different countries. The world's divided up into different regions, and they all get different IP addresses. Then the local authorities there can hand them on to the internet service providers. Okay, we've now got IPv6, which is coming out, and there's actually a test day coming up in the next few months, in June sometime, I think, that actually allows you to go onto a website to see if your equipment can handle an IPv6. And they call this, there's a term for it, I think it's called dual stacking or something. I'll see if I can't find the article. Here we go. Where is it? Just bear with me. I had an article here, and they refer to it as multi-stacking, I think it is. Just all the ads here got in this article. Basically, I'm just looking for this article, and there's a term here that some websites are going to become... June 8th it is. Dual stack websites, they're called. The term's called dual stacking, which means they have both IP stacks. They're running the IPv4, and they'll accept the request from a host running IPv4, and they will also accept the request from a host running IPv6. There is a couple of test sites here, apparently, that will allow you to test. Now, it also says here none of the consumer-grade Linksys or Cisco brand of routers or Linksys brand of routers can yet support it, so that's rather interesting. Now, Windows, since Service Pack 2 of Windows XP, has been able to support IPv6. Mac OS and Linux can already support it, so, of course, anyone running Vista or Windows Service Pack 3 or Windows 7 should be fine. I've seen it on my system. I've not yet configured it because I simply don't know how. I'm sincerely hoping it's dynamic and it's working. I must check with Craig, who knows about the firmware for my own router, to see if it's been supported. But even then, I don't know whether my internet service provider supports it yet, so we're going to have to hit one of these websites mentioned here in the article to find out whether I can see an IPv6 website. All right, so let's have a look. As of the time of the note's been written, they were about to run out. So here we go. One solution to the problem is to reserve some IP addresses back in IPv4 land, which is our 32-bit IP addresses, was to reserve some private addresses for use exclusively inside an organization. These are non-routable IP addresses that don't get to see that don't get to see the outside world. This allows hosts within an organization to communicate with one another without the need of a unique public IP address. For example, if Kim had 192.168.0.1 for her computer, and I have over this 192.168.1 for my computer, they're not going to conflict because they're private IP addresses. They don't actually get to see each other. RFC 1918 is a standard that reserves several addresses for each of the classes of A, B, and C. There's a table described here in the notes that basically outlines what I've outlined before about the amount of the networks you can have and the hosts you can have for each of the networks. A very large organization can use a Class A network. If you're using the Class A private networking, that allows for, as it says here in the notes, over 16 million private addresses. You probably won't need to know this for the exam. Just remember the figure 16 million. I've got it actually here as 16,777,241 hosts. So probably plus two if you want to talk about the actual addresses because of the broadcast and network address. All right. Okay, it says here in the notes on medium-sized networks, you'd use a Class B. And, okay, I'm just going to scan through this because some of it I've already actually told it to you. Now, there's also private addresses that can be used for diagnostic testing of devices. And this type of address is known as a loopback address. And in the Class A area, we have 127.0.0. And this is reserved as a loopback address. Now, I'm just going to skim through some of this. Now, if we also want to check the local host address, some of you may have seen 127.0.0.1. And that's basically, if you can ping that, it's pinging localhost. It's like typing ping space localhost. If you type ping.127.0.0.1, and if you can't ping that, then there's no point even trying to ping Google or pinging your local router or anything. If you can't ping your local host address, I'm not talking about the local loopback one here, but the local host address, then basically you've not got a TCP/IP stack, and there's no point troubleshooting any further. And that's why we isolate these things out. Kim and I were doing some troubleshooting on the weekend, and we were getting a friend of ours to ping a router or ping a modem to see if the modem was actually behaving and was there. Had she not been able to do that, I would have asked her to ping 127.0.0.1, but I know she could see a router, so that I know that was working. But yeah, even the troubleshooting process, you can't ping localhost, then don't even bother trying to ping your router. And of course, if you can't ping your router, don't even bother trying to ping Google or Cisco. It's not going to work. Okay, in addition to all of this, we also categorize IP addresses as unicast, broadcast, or multicast. Now, as we know from some of our earlier discussions, hosts can use addresses to communicate one-to-one, one-to-many, or one-to-all, which is unicast being one-to-one, broadcast one-to-many, and multicast one-to-many.
Isn't that the other way around?
Now, unicast addresses... Oh God! Did I make it?
A multicast is one to many, isn't it? And broadcast is one to all.
Maybe I did.
No, you said it around the other way.
Oh, did I? Anyway, it's in the notes, basically. Okay, we know a packet with a unicast address is intended for a specific host. Okay, an example of this would be a host with an address of 192.168.0.1.5. requesting a web page or some service from another host on the same network at 192.168.1.200. Okay, for a unicast packet to be sent and received, it must have a destination IP address in the packet. A corresponding MAC address must also be present in the frame header. Remember, packets, we talk about framing and packets, and we talk about, frame header, we talk about framing, we talk about MAC addresses and frames, and we talk about IP addresses and packets. Okay, with a broadcast, a packet can contain a destination IP address with all ones in the host portion, which means all hosts on that broadcast domain will receive the message. And that's why that packet will actually have 255 in the IP in the last octet of that IP address, because it's all ones. Many protocols such as ARP and DHCP use broadcast. Okay, so a standard Class C network here with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0 has a broadcast address of 192.168.1.255. So anything with a 255 in the packet there will be deemed as a broadcast address and a broadcast packet. And if I'd done my binary stuff correctly before, we would have worked out that 255 is equal to all ones in that octet, which we proved by adding up all of those columns that we did before, and that's why. Okay, so I'll let you read the equivalence for the Class A and the Class C sections. Okay, so basically it says here in the notes, a broadcast IP address for a network needs a corresponding MAC address in the Ethernet frame. And on a Ethernet network, the broadcast MAC address is 48 ones, which is ff.ff.ff, it's actually ff-ff-ff-ff-ff-ff, which is a hexadecimal number, all ones. Now, multicast enables, as we've already discussed, a source device to send a message to a group of devices. Devices that belong to a multicast group are assigned a multicast IP address. Okay, now the range of multicast addresses are from the range of 224.0.0.0 to 2439.255.255.255. Now, these addresses can only be used for the destination in a packet. the source will always have a unicast address because it has to come from the course, so it has to come from the source. So it so basically you can only see the multicast address in the destination part of the packet, and for that to work you still have to send it from an original host which would have a unicast address. Examples of where multicast addresses are used are in examples like remote gaming, where users can be connected but remote from each other. Another example of this type of addressing would be distance through learning, learning by distance, which is what we're doing now. Many people are connected to the same class, so I'm the source and you people are the destinations, but it's only to a select group of people. It's only the people who have logged on here today. These also need a multicast MAC address to be delivered. The frames need a multicast MAC address to be delivered to hosts on the same network. The multicast address is a special value beginning of, with the values of 0100-5E in hexadecimal. All right, now that's probably glazing a few people's eyes over here. I just want to do a time check, and we're at 9:05, so we're going reasonably well. Okay, we've got questions here at the moment.
Nope.
All right, I'll have to go back and do some binary later, I think. Okay, 5.3.1, how IP addresses are obtained. Okay, IP addresses can be assigned statically or dynamically. Let's have a look at the static ones first. With a static assignment, a network administrator has to go into the configuration of each of the hosts and type it in, which is really good because the administrator knows what machine's on what part of the network and what network. However, this can be time-consuming and can cause mistakes. Now, at the minimum, this includes the IP address of each host, the subnet address, or the subnet mask, sorry, and the default gateway. Now, static addresses have some advantages. Let's have a look at this. They're useful for printers, servers, and other networking devices that don't move around. If hosts normally access a server on a particular IP address, it wouldn't be good if that server was wandering around about the network, would it? We really need to know where it is. Static assigning of addresses can provide increased control over network resources, but it can be time-consuming to do. When entering IP addresses statically, a host only performs basic error checking. Therefore, errors are more likely to occur. When using IP addressing in an organization, it's important to keep an accurate list of which IP addresses are assigned to which devices. Additionally, these are permanent addresses and not normally used dynamically anywhere else on the network. On a local network, it's often the case that the user population can change. New users can turn up with laptops and need a connection. There are other people in an organization who have workstations and that need a connection to the network. So rather than having a network assigning an IP address for each of the machine, imagine all the sales staff coming in wanting their laptops configured every time they walked into a building. No, it's all too hard. There is a way of assigning IP addresses automatically. This is done using a protocol called DHCP. And does anyone know what DHCP stands for?
Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol.
Absolutely. Well done, Narissa. DHCP. DHCP provides a mechanism for the automatic assigning of information such as IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway. DHCP is generally the preferred method of assigning IP address information to hosts on large networks, as it takes away the burden on network support staff and eliminates entry errors. Another benefit of DHCP is an address is not permanently assigned to a host, and it is actually leased for a period of time. If a host is powered down or taken off the network, the address is returned to the pool for further use. And of course, this is especially helpful for mobile users that come and go. Okay, if you're into a hotspot, a wireless area in a hotspot in a wireless in a place like an internet cafe, a coffee shop, or an airport, like I did when I was traveling through LA International Airport, etc., a dynamically assigned IP address was given to my machine. As I entered the area, my DHCP client, active on my computer, contacted the local DHCP server via the wireless connection to obtain an address. The DHCP server then assigns a address to your laptop. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if they've got actually how it works here. Okay, with most medium to large networks, they're running DHCP software. Sometimes it's on a dedicated PC server. In the home based and small office network, the DHCP server is usually located in the integrated services router. So we discussed last week or the week before how these routers, these integrated ISRs, integrated services routers, they have a switch in them. They have a router so they can switch you between the local network and the internet. Or the router so they can route you between the local network and the internet. They have a wireless access point and some of them have a modem in them. They also have a DHCP server, which will assign an IP address to usually your computer. I have it running here. I only use the laptops on DHCP. I tend to bolt down the two permanent machines for obvious reasons. Now, I have a feeling there's a test alert here. These routers can also, not only have they got a DHCP server built into them, these integrated devices, they also have a DHCP server, a DHCP client built into them. And the reason for that is they can obtain an IP address from your internet service provider, and that is the public IP address. For example, mine is 110.175.41.16. Now, that's the public address, and that's always given to me every time I log on. If I had a true static address, a dynamic address rather, I'd get something different every time I log on. A good example of this is I see Kim logging on to my system to use the server, or to call me on Fidelifone when we're doing movies. And I've got a range of different IP addresses that she's called in from, because every time she logs off the internet, which isn't that often because she leaves her router going all the time, she comes in from a different IP address. The same would occur to Narissa, who's on cable, and as for Pat, I think Pat said she was on DSL the other week, and the same might occur on DSL, unless you've especially asked for your company, your internet service provider, to provide you with the same address every time you log on, which is what happens here with my ISP, TPG. So, the integrated services devices can act as both a DHCP client and a DHCP server. Any questions at this point? Well, I'll just scroll down because I was doing that all off the top of my head and I've got to read the bit that says it in the notes. Any questions? Evidently,
nope.
I've glazed you over. Are we all confused?
No, we're fine.
Good. Okay. No. When a host is configured as a DHCP client, it has no addressing information, no IP address, no subnet mask, and no gateway. It gets this information from a DHCP server, either on one located on your local network or one located on your ISP. Now, there are these people who use just straight through modems and connect their computers. It's becoming less common now. If they connect their computer straight with a modem onto the internet service provider, they'll be assigned the public IP address. And that means it's going to be open to the internet and vulnerable from attacks. That host will be vulnerable from attacks. Anyway, the DHCP server, wherever it is configured with a pool or a range of IP addresses that it's allowed to hand out. Here we go. Now, our Kylie has a wonderful little acronym for this, and I can't remember what it was. Do you remember what it was, Kim?
If it's what you're thinking of. Oh, sorry, Kim.
So the Discover, yeah.
DORA, D-O-R-A.
That's it, DORA. Discover, yeah. I was going to write it down. Discover, offer, Yeah, I'm just sort of trying to pick at the keywords out of here. Request and acknowledge.
Discover, that's offer, it. Request, now, and acknowledge.
Acknowledge. Yeah. Okay, let's find out why she came up with Dora. Cisco don't actually tell us about Dora, but Kylie does, and Kylie's cool. All right, so let's have a look. A client, like a computer, that needs an IP address will send a Discover message, a DHCP Discover message, actually, which is a broadcast message, with a destination IP of 255.255.255.255, which is all ones, which is how many bits, gang?
32.
32 bits, yep. Okay. And it will send that with a destination MAC address of all Fs to, which is 48 bits, by the way. MAC address is 48 bits, in case I'm neglected to tell you. Out across the network. This is a broadcast message, and all hosts are going to receive this broadcast message. Splat. Well, it's a broadcast seed DHCP frame as well, it will receive. But only the DHCP server will reply. So there you go. Everyone gets this broadcast message. That's why, yeah, we do like to limit the broadcast traffic, but there's inevitably going to be some broadcast traffic. But only a DHCP server on the network will reply. A server will respond with a DHCP offer. Here's the OBIT for Kylie's Dora. It will suggest an IP address to the client. That's the offer. Okay. Kim's got a new computer out of the box. She turned it all on the other day and was offered, let's say, for example, 192.168.0.2 because it might be her other machine might be turned on. And the machine went, yep, I've been offered that address. Beauty, I think I'll have it. Okay, the host, in other words, Kim's second machine, her new machine out of the box, sends a request, which is the R part of Dora, to the DHCP server asking to use that address. So it says, okay, I've been offered 192.168.0.2. I am sending a request to use that address that you've offered me. The server, the DHCP responds, the DHCP server responds with an acknowledgement, and that's the A for Dora. So is that making sense, good old Dora?
Yes.
Discover, offer, request, and acknowledge. And if you remember it in that way, I have a feeling there are some exam test questions on that. Okay, there's a description of a diagram here, which basically just outlines what I've said. So when you read your notes, you'll hear that. Okay, there's also, what's going on here? Okay, there's a bit here in the notes that says configure a Linksys integrated services router. They talk a lot about that in the later chapters. And what will then happen is you will configure the DHCP server in some of these things. Oh, here we go. With your normal Linksys stuff, it's usually the default address is 192.168.1.1, and the subnet mask is usually obviously 255.255.255.0. And how many bits is that, gang?
32.
Okay, yep, but how many bits is used in, how many bits are set to 1 is what I should have asked you.
Sorry, what was that?
24,
yep. So we have 25, in the default subnet mask of this Linksys integrated router, we have 255.255.255.0. That means there's 24 bits set to 1 because it's using up the first 24 bits of that address. And the last octet is 0, so that would be... 24 bits for the subnet mask, for the default subnet mask on a Class C network. Okay, it will also, incidentally, the IP address of your integrated services router, in the case of the one that they've given the example of here, is 192.168.1.1. That is also the default gateway. So your machine, so if you do an IP config, if Kim were to do an IP config on a new machine and got something like 192.168.0.2 or 0.3 probably, I'm not sure. It's the first machine turned on today, so it might actually get one of the lower IP addresses. She would see that as the IP address. She would see 255.255.255.0 as the subnet mask, and she would see the router's address as 192.168.0.1, I think, actually, if I remember her network well enough. Oh, Pat's left. Okay, so I'll just skip that. We're actually up to 5.4, which is where I actually did want to break it. Are there any questions so far?
Nope, none from me.
Nope.
No.
Okay. I'm just thinking I might do a manual conversion of this address. No, I might actually just practice those during the week and come back to you. So I wanted some more time to prepare. Just wondering, we've got half an hour out. Hang on, if people could hang on for a sec. There's some exercises in the worksheets. I wanted to actually see if I could convert these IP addresses out, but that doesn't seem to allow the standard hexadecimal and binary stuff here in the Windows calculator anymore. Stand by for a sec, Boone. Where the hell's the scientific calculator gone? Oh, I found it. Here we go. Set that to binary. Okay. Converting out 192 is 11000000. So it's actually two ones and a lot of zeros. And I'm just trying to debate whether we should actually get people to do this manually. What do you think, Narissa?
Up to you.
Oh, well, I can get people to do it. Why not? Okay, stand by. Okay, sorry about that. I was hitting the wrong key. Okay, let's see if we can actually do this manually, and I can explain it in a way for visioning people to understand. If we have eight columns converting, and we're actually going to convert the number 192 to binary, we actually have eight columns, 0 to 7, and we know that 2 to the power of 7 is, what do you think that is, Narissa?
128.
Yep, 128. So what we're going to do is we have the number 192. So the way we do it is we put down a 1 in the next, we actually can't do 192 because it's actually not present. We can't do 192. So we have to start the nearest number that is 128. So what we do is we put a 1 in the 128th column or the 7th column, whichever you'd like to put it. And then we go, well, we have 1 left over. What are we going to do with that 1 left over? Well, we have the next number down is 64. So we put a 1 in the 64th column and we end up with 1. And what have we got left over? Nothing. So we can't put anything in the 32's column. We can't put anything in the 64 in the 16's column. We can't put anything in the 8's column. We can't put anything in the 4's column, nor can we put anything in the 2's column. And we can't put anything in the 1's column. So we just put zeros. And that's why that 192 works out as 11000. I get it right. Hang on. 11000000. So we get all those zeros. Now I'm probably not explaining this very well because I actually don't like doing them. And I'll admit it. I know that during the A plus certification you've got to actually do it manually. But to be honest, the pragmatic me, I always check my answers with the Windows calculator because I come from a business environment where it's important to get things right first up. And I'll always check my answers on the Windows calculator. I don't mind telling people that because if I had a boss breathing down my neck who wanted me to do these calculations, I'm going to get very nervous if I've got to do them. And if I screw up, I want to present to the boss good quality work. I don't want to think, oh, I'm clever because they told me at Cavi to do it in my head. No way. Sorry, I'm not going to do it.
Well, I think when someone's watching or listening, you know, I'd get very nervous.
Well, exactly. So what I'm going to do is convert out decimal 168 for you. Can work out how to use this thing here. Hang on. I hate this new Windows calculator. There's not even a clear button on it. Must be somewhere.
We should try to find a good free one online.
Well, I just haven't used the new one. I just thought it'd be much like the old one. There's a clear button here. No. Interesting. How do I write in? And I'll just have to convert it out and hope I'm right, I guess. I just like to have my, just any good presenter should have a, I have to run a new version of it, I think.
Well, you weren't to know the Windows 7 calculator was different.
Oh, okay, here we go. I'll seem to have to run a new version. I can't find a clear button. Okay, let's see if I can convert that out and get the same number that I wanted, binary. Okay, here we go. Now, if I want to convert out 168 to binary, okay, again, where would I start, Narissa, do you think?
Well, you'd say, now I know how to do, I think I know how to do this, but doing it with other people, I get nervous.
I do too, I hate it. I really don't like it. It's because maths doesn't come easy to me. I'll tell you where to
so
start.
You'd start with 128 column, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's exactly right, because you always start from the 128 column. And in this instance, so we'll hopefully deal with a number that's less than 128 at some point, and we'll show you what to do in that instance. Okay, in this instance, we're dealing with a number that's greater than 128, so it's 168. So we put down a 1 in that column. Okay, so then we say, what is the difference between 168 and 128? And that's 40. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay, so we can't put anything down in the 64s column because 64 is greater than 40, so we can't. We actually have to skip that column. So we put down a 0 there. So then what we do is we say we're still left with this 40. Now, the nearest column we've got to that is 32. So we put a 1 in the 32's column because it's the nearest highest number we've got. Remember, it's the nearest highest number. Now,
then
we're still
got
left
eight
with
left
some
over.
Left over. We've got 8 left over. So we can't do anything. I'm going to let that go because this is important. We can't do anything with the 16's column. So we would therefore put a 0 in the 16's column. And then, because we have our 8 left over, we actually do have an 8's column, don't we?
Yes, so you'd put a 1 in the 8's column.
You do. And then you're left with nothing left over in the 4's, the 2's, and the 8 in the 1's column. So you fill that full of zeros. And I'm just going to fill mine full of zeros. And I should get, converting out 168, and I'm going to edit this lecture heavily, 101001000. And that's what I do believe the calculator said. If I can find it, it did. So I actually got it right. But I just don't like it. There are people who can do this sort of stuff drunk, but I can't. So if we, for example, wanted to convert, say, just some random number like 50, for example, what do you think, Narissa, we might do with that?
We'd start at the 128 column. Would you still
start
there?
At the 128 column. So yep. Now, this is a number lower. The last two numbers we did were actually higher than 128, so we actually had something to do with the first column, didn't we?
This time you'd put a zero.
Correct. Now, a lot of people say it's not necessary to put a zero because it's like base 10. You don't necessarily have to put your leading zeros, but we suggest you do, and that is because we'll talk about anding next week. We'll talk a little bit more about what happens to get the network address. The numbers simply will not line up if you don't have your leading zero. So yeah, in the 128 column, which is 2 to the power of 7, we're going to put a 0. And what did I say? It was 50. In the 64's column, that's greater than 50. I just picked a number out of my head. 50 is a good number. Kim, what do you think I'd put in that?
Sorry about that. You'd put a 0.
That's right, because it's greater, so it's our leading zeros, or else some people might put nothing. Okay, so the next number we can do something with is 32. Now remember, I said that we're going to convert out 50, so that's the next one we can put it with. That's the first column of which we can put a 1 in it. So I'm going to put a 1 in that column, because that's the nearest number I can work with, the nearest lowest number I can work with. Okay, so therefore the difference, what's 50 minus 32?
18.
Yep. Obviously, I can't do anything with the 18s. With 18, I can't do anything with the 16s column. So, So 18. So I can put something in the 16s column. I beg your pardon. So that's going to be a 1. And I'm going to go 18 minus 16. Of course, is 2. So I put nothing in the 8s column. Nothing in the 4's column, and I'll put my 1 in the 2's column, and nothing in the 1's column. And let's hope I have not made a fool of myself. I'll check it. And checking that is, yep, I got it right. 1, 1, 1, or 2 leading zeros, so 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. The other thing I wanted to point out is, how do we convert numbers back from binary to decimal?
Don't you add up the powers, like in each column? Like, for example, if there was a 1 in the 16 column, do you say 16?
Yep. You do. Yeah, now I think I might have told you this over a glass of Scotch and Coke one night. You just add up the powers. So let's convert our 50, let's convert our 00, 1, 1, 1, sorry, our 00, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, and what did I say? 0. I might mark that up wrong. Let's convert it back to 50 and see how it's done. Are you ready? Okay, so let's come back to our 8th column, which is 2 to the power of, because we start at 0, 2 to the power of 7 is 250, is 128. Do we all agree on that?
Yes.
Okay, yep. So we've got a 0 there. Okay, 2 to the power of 6 is 64. We've got a 0 in that column, right? So the first column we can do something here is 32. So we go 32. The next column I put a number in from our conversion before was the 16.
So you'd add 32 and 16?
32 and 16 is what?
48.
48 confirmed. Yep, you beauty. So we're adding up the powers with ones in them. Okay, we've got nothing in the 8s column. We've got nothing in the 4s column, but we do have something in the 2s column, and we decided we got to 48 so far. So 48 plus 2 is what?
50.
There you go. So you just add up what's... Wherever you see a 1, you just add up the those powers. So you just say, well, in this instance, there was a 1 in the 32s column, there's a 1 in the 16s column, and there was a 1 sitting there in the 2s column, and you just add them up. Okay, so is that making sense, Marshall? I haven't spoken to you for a bit.
Sure. That's easy. That's not hard, although why would you use binary at all?
Okay, I think the answer to that is... Hang on, we're 38 minutes past. All right, I wish I'd prefer... I thought we were coming up against the time. All right, let's see if I can do this off the top of my head because I didn't prepare for it. Here we go. The reason we use binary is, firstly, the computers look at the IP address as just a binary number. It doesn't see 192.168.0.1 or any of that sort of good stuff. It sees, in the case of these, I wish I'd written it down now, it sees the, hang on, I'll just get the number out. I'm just going to get these numbers out for you. Okay, it would see, okay, the answer to your question, I've just converted this out for you because I didn't want to sort of put you through all that. The computer would see, in the case of, say, Kim's router's address, it would see 11000.1011000.0000000.0000000.0000000001. Now, I hope I haven't got that wrong. Now, that's what it would see. It converts it to binary. Is that making sense, Marshall?
Yes.
It would therefore see, now, I can put you through the pain of working this out. It would see that 255 is all 8 ones. We can practice doing that if you like, or you can believe.
I believe you.
What would you rather
believe
do?
Me. Okay, I believe you.
We can practice working out that 255.25, that 255 is all ones. Okay, now I don't mind practicing it. Okay, so let's write down, if we wrote down her address, her router's address on the top row of a text file, for example, which is, as you know, when you type these addresses in, it's written on the top row. And then the subnet mask is usually written below it. You've probably seen that, gang.
Yes.
Okay, now remember I spoke before of something called the network address.
Yeah.
I'm just going to write this up for a second. Okay, and I think I've got a number short here somewhere. Hang on, let me just check these place values. Okay, I got it. All right, now, remember the network address, and I told you before that the network address is 192.168.0.1. The network address is the first address in each segment of the network. For example, if we'd subnetted Kim's network down to 2 subnets, and I divided it at 192.168.0.127, the next address would, I think, be, and I could correct me if I'm wrong, 128, but you need a network address for each segment of the network. That's for the network traffic. Now, the reason we do this in binary as well, not just for the computer's sake, is that if we wanted to find out that network address, we do a technique known as ANDing. And this is where 1 and 1 don't necessarily make 2. 1 and 1 makes 1. So if we line up the subnet mask in binary under the IP address, and we go 1 and 1 is 1, and 1 and 0 is 0, we're actually going to find the network address out by simply doing the following. This is where Jackie scripts, we talked about that in the JAWS scripting course last year, Marshall, come in very handy because Kim's been using it to read off some stuff in web design, I think, by holding the Alt key down. So Jackie wrote some scripts that if you hold the Alt key down and press the up arrow, it just reads the character above where the cursor is. It doesn't read the whole line. Do you remember us talking about that, Marshall?
Yeah.
Okay, so if I sit on the, say, the row where the subnet mask is, and I know that the subnet mask is all ones except for the last octet, hang on, I'll just correct my notes here I've made wrong. Okay, I'm going to come back to one in the first column of the first octet underneath the one. Remember how we decided that 192 converted to binary was 11 and 6 zeros? You know, you don't have to work it out again, but just believe me. Okay, so if I go one in from the first bit in the first octet, and I add that with one, or end that with one from the first bit in the first octet of the address, I'm going to end up with what? One. If I do it to the second bit in the first octet, again, we know that the subnet mask is going to have a one in that column, and I end that with the one in that part of the IP address, I'm going to also get one. Now, if I do it to the third bit in the first octet, which is the subnet mask will have a 1, the IP address will have a 0. 1 and 0 means 0, because it's an AND process. We have to have two values to make this work. So 1 and 0 is 0. Therefore, I'm going to get a 0 in that column. And the same for the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th, the 8th column of that first octet. So if you look at the second octet, which is the out to binary, which is 1010100, I'm obviously going to end those with the ones, and I'm going to end up with 10101000. I'm going to do the same in the fourth octet. I'm going to end up with all zeros because that was a zero, and ended that with a one. You get all zeros, and the fourth octet, they're all zeros except for the one. So I'm going to end that with a zero. So I'm going to end that with a subnet mask. The fourth octet of the subnet mask was also all zeros, but the IP address had a one in it. But because one and zero are still zero, I'm going to end up with a zero value for the fourth octet for the network address. So therefore, I'm going to conclude, and I know this is probably glazing your eyes over, Kim, and probably most other sane people, I'll end up with an address of 192.168.0.0. Because the one is ended with a zero in the fourth octet, and that's where you get your zero from, and that's how you make your network address. This is important when you do subnetting, and you get weird network addresses all over the place. You've got to be able to end it. Now, the reason we call it ending, how many people out there have seen those light switches where you've got to have both switches on? Well, not so much one switch on or the other switch. Has anyone seen those light switches where you've got like a large room and a light switch at each end of the room?
Sure. They use them in stairwells a lot too.
Yeah, they do. And it can be a right pain in the neck for blind people because you don't know whether the light's on or off. Now that's often referred to as an OR gate because you can actually have one or the other turned on and you'll get one. So the light's on, let's say, looking at that from a binary point of view, we got the light is off is zero, the light is on is one. So you can have one light switch turned on or the other one, and you'll get one. Or you'll get the light going. This is an AND gate. It'll only work if they're both on. So you have to have one and one. So this is in this instance, you might have two switches along a circuit, for example. It's only going to work if both switches are turned on. So you might, for example, have something plugged into a wall outlet, and you may have the two power switch strips or two power boards, that one the switch on the first one has to be turned on, and the switch on the second one has to be turned on to allow the whatever's connected to work. Does that make sense? That's an AND gate.
Oh, I see.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so in this instance, we're ending the values in the binary. So that's why, at least that's the Elise Lonsdale method, and reason why you need to think about this from a binary point of view.
Well, that's a good analogy. It makes it clear.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you I'm glad you approve, because none of this comes easy to me.
I wouldn't like to be trying to teach it.
I'm going to break it at the same point that Jackie broke it at, because we actually are now going to start talking about boundaries and address spaces, and I think being able to be calculated by the use of binary is probably going to be a good segue into the next section of the of Chapter 5. Well, I think we can go home 5 minutes early, 10 minutes early, to be truthful about it. I'm just going to do some editing. Any questions, gang? Let's see who's out there.
Pat's gone. But the rest of us are here.
Yeah, no, and Pat missed the most exciting bit.
Nope, I think I'll just have to read my notes and really get it into my head.
So what's subnetting,
yeah,
and is that in Discovery too?
Subnetting is the technique of dividing a network down into smaller components. And the way you do it is that you have to know this stuff about the network boundaries. Now I'm just sort of going from my own knowledge here. On a network that is using, what we do is we borrow a bit from the host portion of the IP address, and we actually make a subnet mask of 25 bits, not 24 bits. So what because we've taken one bit out of the host portion, we've then immediately halved the number of hosts you can have on each of these network segments. And then you go on to say, okay, each of those network segments have their own broadcast address and their own IP and their own broadcast address and their own network address. And Jackie uses the term boundaries. I think that's the term she used. It's boundaries. Let me think. What was the term she used? It's a. I'll have to look at the lectures that Jackie and I did. She did some private tuition with me.
So if you were teaching Discovery 2, you would, like, this is all in Discovery 2, is it?
Yeah, I've seen it in Chapter 3, I think, of Discovery 2. I would need to work out a good way of quantifying what's in my head, and I know it in my head. And this is where a lot of instructors can go wrong with this, because they can't get it out so that it makes sense. They know it, and it's easy to sort of know once the light bulb clicks, but then you've actually got to turn around and explain it to someone.
Very hard.
So, you know, I can simply say to you, well, all right, well, if we had borrowed 2 bits off the host portion and made a 26-bit subnet mask on a Class C network, we would halve that number yet again, and we would have something like 64 minus 2 hosts on a network. So we'd be building, multiple networks, but with less hosts on them. If, for example, I borrowed yet another bit and made a subnet mask with 27 bits, I'd be then down to 32 hosts on each chunk of my network. If I borrowed made a subnet mask of 28 bits, I'd be down to, I guess it would be 16. 29 is 8. I hope I get this right. 30 is 4, and 31 bits is 2, and 32, you don't do 32. So each of these instances of borrowing a bit from the host, and this is another reason why we have to think in binary for Marshall's question there, is that we can look at these subnet masks in binary and see, you know, like the first octet would have 8 bits of, 8 lots of ones, or 8 ones. The second octet would have eight ones, which would mean, you know, 16 bits. The third octet would have 24 ones, eight ones, which would make you 24 bits. And the third octet would become very interesting. Instead of being all zeros, it would have some ones in it, like a 26-bit subnet mask, for example, would have 2 ones in it, if that makes sense. 2 ones in the fourth octet, to be precise, is what I'm trying to say.
It makes sense.
And this is the way Jackie presented it to me, and she really had a delightful way of doing it. So I had slash, and that's often referred to as slash 26. It's called classless interdomain routing, CIDR. And the reason we call it CIDR, or classless interdomain routing, is because we can do this on, say, networks with 16 bits as a default subnet mask. And then we can do slash 17s and slash 18s and slash 19s, etc., because what we've done is we've borrowed bits from our two octets for the host. Remember, a Class B network has two octets for the network and two octets for the host. So what we're going to do is we're going to borrow some bits off the host and give them to the network component of it, and therefore make a slash 17 or a slash 18 network, and therefore we can divide that down. But the amount of hosts per network obviously become half of our 16,530 something or other hosts on a default Class B. So each time we halve that, we get half of that 16,500 figure, whatever that may be. Hang on, I suppose somebody's going to ask me. It's written down here. 63,534 hosts on a Class B network. If we borrowed a bit from the third octet in that instance, we would instantly halve that figure down to whatever half of 63,534 is. The reason it's 63,534 is because it's really 63,536 possible addresses, but you always have to take two off, one for the broadcast address, one for the network address, and one for the broadcast address on each of your segments. So if anyone was asking, why is it that in chapter 3 we did that worksheet with assign an IP address on 192.168.0.1 and 192.168.1.1 or something, and they didn't talk? That's why. They're different segments. Well, I think that just about wraps it up today. Let's talk about network boundaries and stuff next week. It's all new concepts. Even I find it difficult to think about. I think it's exciting, but I wasn't given a terribly good education at school. Thanks, RVIB. Sorry, but I'll say it. So, mathematics in adult life doesn't come as easy to me as it might to others. So I hope it's at least been of some useful to you, this lecture.
Good on you, Elise.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's good, because it gets... I've seen some subnets that are bizarre up at work, and I wondered what they were doing.
Yeah, well, that's what they're doing. They're messing with... different segments and that sort of stuff, and there's a reason, and I'll go through the notes and find out whether that boundary thing is exactly what Jackie and I are talking about, and then we might talk about that. So I'm a little bit... Chapter 5 is one of those chapters that, it's quite intense, but I think at this point it's a good place to stop, because we did talk a little bit about binary and stuff, and I've got a bit of editing to do.
Well, have a good week, everybody.
Sure. Did you get that?
You too, Marshall.
Didn't you get that archive I sent to you yesterday, Marshall?
Yes, I did. And de-archived it and did a quick review of Chapter 5 and a review of Chapter 3, and I got to do some more reviewing for it to penetrate my furry little brain.
That's all right. But I'm sure once it does, come and chat to us on Skype anytime, and I'm sure it'll all click into place. Both those chapters are new concepts, as I said, so it's not unusual to have difficulty with those. The best of us do.
Well, have a good week.
You too. Okay, thanks everyone for attending, and we'll see you for Chapter 5, Part 2, same time next week.
Thanks a lot, Elise.